This is the You Can Learn Chinese podcast, part of the Seneca Network from SUP China. For everyone who's trying to learn Chinese or reaching for the next level, you came to the right place. I'm your host, Jared Turner, longtime resident of China, co-founder of the Mandarin Companion Graded Reader Series, and people who can't tell the difference between whole numbers and decimals are missing the point. My co-host is John Pasden, co-founder of Mandarin Companion, founder of All Set Learning, the Chinese grammar wiki, Sinosplice.com, and told me that 99% of German shepherds are dogs. What if you are struggling to read even the simplest graded readers? Today, we're going to discuss steps you can take to bridge that gap and get to the point where you can begin reading to experience the snowballing effects of reading in Chinese. Guest interviews with Abigail Washburn, a Grammy Award-winning bluegrass musician whose plans to attend law school in Beijing were derailed by a record deal. Don't miss this interview. All this and more, let's get to it. Hey guys, this is Jared Turner coming at you from Utah in the United States.
Hi guys, my name is John Pasden. I'm in Shanghai, China. How's everybody doing?
All right, JP, before we kick into today's episode, we have a few reviews. You want to kick us off?
All right, so the first one is from Don Monroe. He says, "Where can I buy books? Hey guys, I just listened to a couple of your podcasts yesterday while driving to Shanghai, and you have inspired me to take the plunge to try to improve my Chinese reading, which, after almost 20 years in Hangzhou, is limited to restaurant menus and road signs. Is there somewhere I can order online in China? I prefer books to the electronic versions. Look forward to your reply. All the best, Don."
Hey, thanks, Don. We really appreciate it. And sadly, we do get this email quite frequently. People asking, where can I get the books in China? And right now, we just don't have distribution in China. We hopefully will have in the future, but it's a kind of a complicated situation.
Yeah, publishing in China is a huge hassle. And so we're foreign books in China, even though they're in Chinese. And it's just not that easy to get our books in bulk to China. But we're working on it.
Okay, our next review is from Chantal. And she says, "Hi, Jared and John. Hope the two of you are having a wonderful day. I'm a 15-year-old student from the Philippines, and I've been learning Chinese for 8 months now because of you guys. Every podcast episode sends an enormous surge of motivation whenever I feel down when it comes to learning Chinese, and I can't thank you guys enough for all you've contributed to the Chinese learning community. Fei chang, fei chang, gan xie. Much love and appreciation, Chantal." Hey, Chantal, this is one of the more rewarding emails I've received. I love hearing this. She's a 15-year-old girl and learning Chinese. Hey, that's awesome. You can do this.
Yeah, I don't often think of myself as a cheerleader, but I'm glad that we're getting you pumped up to learn Chinese. Okay, so we have another email. One more. This one is a slightly Sapir-Whorfian question. "Hi, Jared and John. Question I'd be interested to hear addressed. Have either of you noticed any changes to the way you think and or perceive as a result of becoming fluent in Mandarin? I guess it might be hard to tease that apart from the general influence of close exposure to Chinese culture and society. Maybe the question isn't highly relevant to your podcast, though in one way it is perhaps. At a minimum, it's interesting. And for the curious, questions like these may be one aspect of their motivation for learning." So that's from Chris Bennett. I think that is an interesting question. We're not going to make a whole podcast out of it, but I think we can answer it. I feel like it's not like something as mysterious as rewiring your brain. But I have noticed that my perception changes as my knowledge changes. So, for example, when I look at noodles now, they're no longer just noodles. It's like, oh, yeah, those are wheat noodles or those are rice noodles. Or, in English, we're more likely to call it just something, a noodle or a dumpling.
But dumpling's the worst, right?
Yeah, China has so many different words for different kinds. It's like, come on, guys, the shape is just slightly different. Do you really need another word? Yes, they do. So, I feel like I've become more sensitive to those kinds of distinctions. How about you, Jared?
I think something that's really impacted me is I think about the concept of translation. And, I get a bit, I'm a religious guy. And, I think about in the Bible, there's a lot of different translations and people want to translate it in many different ways. And they get so stuck on an exact verbiage or meaning of something. And recognizing now that, whoa, hey, wait a second. You can't get so stuck on the exact word and the place of that. It's because things never translate one-to-one, And so I think about that quite a bit when I'm dealing with something like that or dealing with anything, I guess, on an international basis and reporting even. Translation doesn't capture everything. And you've got to recognize that there's some loosey-goosey in there. You know, it can be mean number of different things.
Yeah, and for the Bible specifically, it was not written in English.
Nope.
But one other thing that comes to mind, though, is like when I talk about relatives, I'm used to just saying, oh, my cousin or, my grandfather. But when I speak Chinese, the perception changes a little bit because like I have to know more before I can say that. It's like, all right, which side of my family is this cousin on? Like, is this person older or younger than my mom? And it just like slows me down. So it's not really perception. Although I guess if there were a perception issue, it would just be like, these are really annoying in Chinese because like you have to be clear on all this family tree information before you can say a word.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It gets pretty complex on the Chinese side.
All right. So, Chris, not super deep, but hopefully that scratches the itch you were feeling just a little bit.
All right, John. So what are we talking about today?
All right. So I've mentioned before that I have a consulting company called All Set Learning. And we help learners that are working on their Chinese. Some of them come to us through You Can Learn Chinese, and some of them are working on the Mandarin Companion graded readers as they're listening to our podcast. This probably comes as no surprise to a lot of you. So recently I had a session with Steven in Canada, and we were talking about his situation. He once did a three-month program in China. You know, he wants to be able to learn Chinese down the road, but he's having a bit of a problem now, like really getting into reading. And he owns one of our breakthrough level graded readers, the Xiaoming story, Boy Sherlock. And he's having trouble reading it. So I think his problem is something that some of you might be facing or you might anticipate facing it. So I wanted to address a little bit what can be done for this particular problem. So before I get into this, we did mention before in podcast number 47, how to learn to read Chinese, baby steps to real reading. We did mention how to start learning to read. But I think Steven's situation is a little special in that he's kind of gotten through those baby steps, but he's still not quite able to read a breakthrough level reader.
Yeah, so this is definitely something I think we didn't quite address. And for any of the listeners, you know, reminder that breakthrough level at Mandarin Companion is 150 basic characters. So, I mean, maybe it doesn't sound like a lot, maybe to someone who's a little bit more beyond that level, but, you know, it also can seem like a lot to someone just starting out. And we're not just about 150 characters. It's a lot more words than 150 characters as well. So, yeah, there's a lot more to it.
Yeah, and I should mention that it is ideal when you start reading a graded reader that your level is a little bit above the material. Like you're not constantly running into new words and characters. You're probably reading super slowly. You're like, wow, this is so easy. But wow, I'm reading really slowly. That's okay. And that's actually a good mm-hmm. situation to be in.
That's right. Many of us have encountered that situation where maybe you know all the characters or words in a sentence, but you don't know the meaning. You're not sure exactly what it said. You know, that's a great place to be, especially when you get into that breakthrough level, right? Because you're starting to put that language together and start to hopefully make sense to you.
Okay, but again, that was not Steven's problem. Steven's no. problem was he would open up the Xiaoming story and the keywords, which we have given pinyin in English for, were needed. He didn't know those words or those characters, but he also had some other words on every page that he didn't know either the characters or the words for. Now, obviously, if you don't know like most of the words in the story, you're not going to want to try to read it. That's just too painful. Because we prefer that the reading is not super hard for you when you first get into it, we don't offer a lot of guidelines as to like how many characters exactly should you know. Like ideally, it's more than what's in the book, right? But like if you only know 100 characters and the breakthrough level is 150, that's probably still going to be too hard.
At that stage, you're probably going to be at around a 60% comprehension. That is far into the reading pain territory. Remember, below 90% comprehension, we're talking about reading pain. So ideally, you're going to want to be above that 90%. And even that 95 can be challenging.
And I had another client who was having exactly this problem. She was definitely below 100 characters, and then she just wanted to brute force it. Like, I'll just learn all the characters and all the words in every chapter and just go through it. And that usually just doesn't work. It turns into like a, you know, some kind of massive flashcard exercise, and it's possible, but you're not really reading.
We've experienced and we talked to people who've done this, and you really got to be highly motivated and you got to be really dedicated to do it, because there is pain that you're going to have to work through if you want to do it like that. And frankly, there are better ways. And that's what we're going to get into here.
Okay, so Steven's situation. He didn't know the keywords, and those were provided at the bottom, so that was good. And then for each page of the book, there were probably like a couple other words that he either wasn't sure of or didn't know. So this kind of level of comprehension is, it's going to be very slow going, but if you really want to stick to it, it is doable. But talking to him, I discovered one of the other problems he had was that he was using the electronic version, and there were a lot of words that he wanted to look up. So he'd be going through this process of like reading a little bit, coming to a word he doesn't know, like copying it, switching to some other app, looking it up, going back to the story. If you're only doing that occasionally, you know, like a couple times a chapter, that's okay. But when you're just doing it like every couple lines, it starts to get pretty tedious. And he would find that he could get through a whole chapter, you know, it would take a while, but he could get through a whole chapter, and he just wasn't really that confident that he really grasped everything he had just read. And, you know, he could like even start over and it would still be kind of hard.
Yeah, this is a problem that people commonly will encounter and may not realize what's really going on here. So, you know, there are some of these types of apps and maybe methods we might use to bridge that gap that we have for the content that we're reading. And the thing about this is that I'm reminded of this one app I saw. It's like, click your way to fluency. And when the idea was you could click on the character, pop up the definition, and then there you go. You could learn the character or word, hypothetically learn the character or word, and then, you know, start accelerating your Chinese learning that way. But the problem with that is that it's not too different than maybe like having pinging above the characters. And along this concept, imagine if it just one more step, you had pinging above characters, and then you had the English translation above that. Your eyes and your mind, your mental focus is going to be more on that pinyin and the English translation. And it takes a lot of your focus on the off of the character. And when that happens, you start to really understanding it in English. You'll start maybe translating things in English, and you're actually end up using English quite a bit more than you would than if you were just trying to understand it in Chinese and it was at a better level of comprehension for you. So as a result, what kind of happens is that your comprehension's in English, your understanding is in English, and therefore you don't really get that solid understanding in Chinese.
Okay, so Stephen was dealing with that, but then he also had what, I don't know, I'd call this the one screen problem. So he has to keep switching between apps, and it just kind of slows him down, and he's having trouble keeping it all in his brain. So what I told him to do, and he's going to do this going forward, is to make sure you have kind of a two-screen approach, and one of the screens or both of the screens might be made of paper. So, for example, maybe you have the paper books. We'll do the exact opposite. You have a paper book, and then you have a little notebook. So you go into page one, and there's like two different words that aren't keywords that you don't know. So you write down in your notebook, page one, and then you write down those two words. Now, I said paper, which means you have to write them by hand. Now, you don't have to do it this way, but any time when writing characters by hand is something I recommend, it's this time. When the characters are still new to you and you're having trouble like really imprinting them on your memory, then having to write them into your notebook is going to imprint them a lot better than like, say, switching over to an app, pasting in, checking the definition, and then switching back, right? So you have the two screens. In this case, they're paper. You're writing the words for each page. You know, you get to page two, you have two more words, you write those down. And then when you get to the end of the chapter, you have, you know, a list of words that you didn't know. So you're going to want to look through that. You might discover that some of them appear more than once. That's okay. You have it labeled by page. And then when you go through and you try to read this chapter a second time, it's so much nicer because you got your notes right there. And if you do this like once or twice, you'll find that you can stop looking at your notes. And then you can actually start to feel progress. Whereas when you're just like switching between apps, you're not feeling that.
That's a fantastic method. And I think also to clarify for our listeners, if you've listened to many of our past podcasts, you know, we're not huge advocates of like handwriting. And I think, but the difference here is that this is using handwriting as a tool to remember as opposed to learning to really handwrite fluently, and that's, which is a whole different skill set. And so, you know, this is like maybe writing them 5-10 times can be helpful. We're not huge advocates of, you know, writing those characters hundreds of times, you know what I mean, before to really get those to stick, unless you're super interested and motivated in doing so. But this is definitely an instance of where, you know, learning to handwrite a little bit and doing a little bit of practice helps that imprint it into your mind.
Yeah, and to be clear, I'm advocating here writing the character exactly one time for every time you want to add it to your notes for each page that appears on. So if you can't remember this character and it keeps coming up and you keep writing it, well, guess what? That's helping you remember it. Whereas if it only appears once and you need to write it once, that's probably okay.
And I will say this is that, you know, I've spent, I think, hundreds of hours writing characters with my son when he was in school. And you know, when you actually get down and you write some of those characters, you start to be able to more, I guess, concretely divide the different components in your head. And I've even had some instances where a otherwise complex character, I can remember how to write it because it was made up of 3 or 4 simpler components that are easier or something you already know.
All right, cool. So getting back to the two-screen approach, though, I used an example of a paper book and a notebook. So obviously, you might have an electronic version on like an iPad or some other screen, and then you have paper notes. Or maybe you have electronic notes and a paper book, or maybe, you know, 2 digital screens, whatever. The important thing is that you have these 2 screens so that you can quickly check your notes. You're not writing on the book itself, especially the paper book. Because as you learn these words and characters, you want to be able to read them fluently without help. And, you know, marking that up is going to make that more difficult. But not having to switch back and forth between apps and just having it right there to the side. You know, it's not on the screen you're reading. This is kind of critical. It's not right there on the screen. When you're reading, you're focused on one screen. But when you know you can't read, you have the other screen to the side. So that's going to save you time, but it's also not distracting. And it's going to improve your reading.
But there's also more that you can do, right?
All right. So another really important thing that came up when I was talking to Steven on our call was that he estimated that he was spending about an hour a week trying to read. And, you know, time that you invest into learning Chinese is an important factor of how quickly you're making progress. And the way it works is the lower your level, the less time you need to invest to make progress. But as you start, you know, increasing in level, you're really going to have to invest more time in order to actually see progress. So, you know, he's trying to get to this critical mass of like 150 to 200 characters so he can start reading the breakthrough level books. And that's good. That's a good goal. But if you're only doing an hour a week and you're noticing that, you know, this stuff isn't really sticking, then that's probably just not enough. So he needed to kind of reassess how much time he had for his studies, maybe break up his studies into smaller pieces. He could do flashcards if he wanted to, you know, used spaced repetition maybe. But, you know, once a week, the stuff just wasn't sticking. So it wasn't helping him to get through the book.
Absolutely. I mean, and, you know, we have addressed this before. And, you know, if you've only got like an hour during the week, or that's at least what you want to allocate, you're going to get a lot more benefit out of splitting that time up, even at like, even as little as 10 minutes a day, as opposed to spending one day a whole hour. There's something about that, you know, if you look into the research behind the forgetting curve, you know, it's really, you know, what is the most important thing to study? It's what you learned yesterday. And so constantly, you know, getting that repetition in, even if it is small, even if you don't have a lot of time or you're not willing to devote a lot of time right now, or you just want to, you know, try it out as something more recreational, just put a little bit time in consistently every day.
That's right. Consistent efforts definitely add up. And speaking of adding up, that gets to my final point about this issue, which is you really want to get this snowball effect going. So once you can start reading a breakthrough level book, 150 characters, The first book is going to be the hardest, but every additional book after that not only is easier and more enjoyable, but it also, relatively efficiently and not too painfully, is moving you towards level one. So, you know, imagine the snowball rolling downhill. You're no longer, you know, taking notes and, you know, reviewing your notes and forgetting all the time. You're actually building vocabulary through reading, and it's so much nicer.
Oh, John, this is what I experienced. You know, back when I was learning Chinese and I was in China, I had learned about graded readers and I got a couple of these things. And at the time, my Chinese, it wasn't conversational. It was like broken. I knew some words and stuff, but didn't know how to put it together. And I got these, one of these graded readers, and I'm just like this, just exactly like you're saying. It was slow. I had to look up some characters. I started to get it. I mean, by the time I got halfway through the book, I was reading a little faster. By the time I got to the end of the book, I was like, wow, I read a book. And then I read another one, and then another one, and then another one. And I didn't feel like, it was the craziest thing. It was like, I didn't feel like I was really studying. It's just I was seeing all the language in context. And it just started to click in my head. And I was all of a sudden able to speak Chinese at a conversational level and understand people. And it just, it made this huge quantum leap in my Chinese. And my coworkers are saying, Jared, what are you doing? Your Chinese has gotten so much better. I'm like, I'm just reading books. And I felt like I was cheating on a test, you know, but there it was. I just, my Chinese was getting better by reading. There's a neurolinguist whose hypothesis is saying that, hey, the best way to, you know, learn a language is just see lots of sentences, you know, in context. And, you know, it's kind of like, hey, that's what you're getting when you're doing extensive reading or you're reading comprehensible input, is you're just seeing a lot of natural language and how it's used in many different ways. And how can that not help your Chinese? How can that not help your language development? Well, it does.
Yeah, and of course, you are going to need a fair amount of input. It's not like just reading one book and breakthrough is going to get you to level one, and reading one book in level one. It's not quite that fast. You are going to have to read a fair amount. But the point is, it's way more enjoyable than like this, you know, reviewing notes and forgetting and, you know, trying to review more often. So the point I made to Stephen was, if you're close to being able to read breakthrough, then doesn't it make sense to spend a little more time now in a concerted effort to push that snowball to the edge of the hill and let it start rolling? Because, you know, why are you just like nudging it an inch every week when you're pretty close to the edge? Like, you want to get that snowball effect going. So just keep in mind, if you're close to being able to read breakthrough, then this can be motivating that you're close to getting that snowball effect going. So, you know, don't give up. Put in the effort and the time it takes so that you can actually start reading and enjoying your learning.
Now, I want to put just a little finer point on that snowball effect and why you start to see that. Now, we always talk about, you know, this breakthrough, for example, 150 basic characters, and you know, you can read one of these books. Now, that book, at least the breakthrough levels, are around, 5,000 characters long? Is that right, John?
Yeah, around there, maybe a little more.
So, and there's about 10 chapters in there, so once you read a chapter, you're going to go through maybe 500 to 600 characters, all right? So the sooner you can get to reading, you're going to have an opportunity to build that reading speed. And so let's just say, like, right now, if you're not at the reading level of, like, breakthrough, and you're still kind of doing flashcards, and maybe you're doing some sentences and things like that, if you did a half hour of studying, you think about how many characters are you really, like, reading and encountering. It may not be a lot. It may be only as little as a few hundred. But once you start getting into extensive reading level where you can actually read a book and comprehend it, and you start building reading speed, at the beginning you may be like, you know, 20 characters a minute, and maybe even slower. But you start to build, and I see this with people. I've worked with people on this, is that you can start getting 80 characters a minute, 100 characters a minute, 120 characters a minute. And so if you were reading for only 10 minutes, I mean, heck, you do the math. You could go through, you know, one to two chapters in 15 minutes. And now you're getting 1,000 characters input every 15 minutes. And now you start to say, you go through a whole book. Now you hit 5,000 characters. And when you're studying at a low level, you may not get 5,000 character input. I don't know. It might take a long time to hit that. But now you go through a second book, another 5,000, another 6,000, another. And so by the time you hit all, like, for example, in our series, the breakthrough level, you probably will encounter at least 25 to 30,000 characters. And so if you think about that, you're going to get all that exposure, like 30,000 character repetition of just 150 character set. That is one of these big reasons you start getting that snowball effect, is because you see that repetition in context over and over again, and it starts to pound it into your head.
Guys, this is science. This is objective, observable phenomena here.
It's math.
The biggest issue, I think, is motivating yourself to do it, but it is possible. Steven's going to do it. You can do it too. You can learn Chinese. You can learn to read Chinese.
You definitely can learn. Now it's time for a word from our sponsor. And today our sponsor is
Mandarin Companion, specifically the breakthrough level book, Xiaoming Boy Sherlock.
Oh, this was a fun story to write. This specific Mandarin Companion graded reader is at the breakthrough level, uses only 150 basic characters. And what we did for this story is we split it up into it's actually a collection of three smaller stories that build on each other.
Yeah, I think this is one reason this story and a few of our other ones appeal to really beginner level readers. You actually have the sense of closure if you can make it through, you know, three or four chapters, one story ends.
It's an excellent way to break that up and to really get yourself into reading. And if it's a little bit of a stretch, you know, we can take some of those tips from this episode and kind of work your way into it. If you're at that level, that's great. Go ahead and jump into it. You're going to get that 5,000 to 6,000 character exposure after reading that entire book. You can go get it today. You can find it on Amazon, iBooks, or Kobo, or wherever you get your books.
All right, so now it is time for Rants and Raves.
All right, John, what do you got for us today? Do you have a rant or do you have a rave?
I have a rave. So, you know, one of the issues with learning Chinese is that when you get to the intermediate level, it can be difficult to find appropriate learning materials. And there's this YouTube channel that's been around for a while. It's called Mandarin Corner. They do have some, like, paid services and products, but they strike me as particularly ungreedy and particularly prolific. Like, they have a lot of really good stuff online. A lot of it's just free. So definitely check it out. Support them if you feel the urge. They have stuff that's like HSK sentences, which I'm not a huge fan of. What I really like are the videos they do where they're on the street just interviewing regular people about all kinds of topics. And then they add subtitles with English translations. These are really interesting. They're authentic. I'm assuming they remove the ones where they're just too hard to understand. They're not super easy, but if you're intermediate, I think you could probably handle it with just a little bit of looking up some words. So it's very cool. Mandarin Corner on YouTube.
I've actually heard of that before.
Yeah, they've been around for a while. Okay, so Jared, how about you? Rant or rave?
Today I have a rave. And this is connected to our interview today. This is an album that was released by Abigail Washburn and Wufei. It is a crossover album of bluegrass music and Chinese folk songs. And Abigail plays the banjo and Wufei plays the guzheng. And it's a pretty cool album. They kind of take some classic Chinese folk tale song. They take some classic Chinese folk songs and merge them with, you know, some bluegrass folk songs, and they got banjo playing and guzheng playing, and it's a pretty fun album. I actually happen to love bluegrass music, and it was a lot of fun to listen to. So you can go find it, you know, on Spotify. YouTube has it. It's Abigail Washburn and Wufei, and I don't actually have a name of the album. I think it's just Wufei and Abigail Washburn.
Are we going to play a quick sample of this music? It sounds intriguing.
Oh, yeah. Here, check this out.
Bye.
Abigail is a Grammy Award-winning banjo-playing bluegrass musician. However, her most pressing role these days is a mother to two young boys. Abigail's story is unlikely as it is fascinating. Even though her life course took a dramatic change, she found ways to infuse two passions together, finding common melodies between two seemingly incompatible worlds. This is an interview you don't want to miss. Stay with us.
I am Abigail Washburn. I'm studying Chinese and keeping Chinese culture and the Chinese diaspora that keeps blowing my mind with all of its beautiful tendrils reaching into cultural possibility is something that I just love exploring and love thinking about.
And you play a little music.
I do,
too,
I do. I play banjo and I sing and I've toured the world.
Well, Abigail, why did you start learning Chinese?
When I got to university, it was required to take a language class, and I saw a poster on the wall that said study Chinese in China. And that was 1996. It was a summer course, and I decided to join the summer course. And the truth of it is that during those 6 or 7 weeks I spent in China between Shanghai and Beijing, I was overwhelmed by the number of people. I was overwhelmed by the pollution. I was overwhelmed by my feeling of not fitting in. I was overwhelmed by how hard the language was. And I came back to the States and felt pretty frustrated and culture shocked. And honestly, like a privileged consumer that got punched in the face. And I thought, oh, well, good riddance. I can choose a different country or different language, or I can just stay here in the States. And I'd always been a person that cared a lot about social justice. But what I didn't think about was how my response to China was really self-involved. I was laying in bed and I had pictures of Martin Luther King Jr. and Gandhi up on the wall. And one morning, like a week after I got back from that trip to China, I looked up at the wall and I saw Gandhi and MLK staring down at me like, so you're not going to go back to China because it was uncomfortable? That's like 1.3 billion people you share this planet with, and you just kind of didn't like it. And that feeling, that presence of them and this mission for if you want to see a change in the world, you got to do it yourself. And the change for me was this sort of self-involved consumeristic American wanting other countries to be like my own. And that I needed to open my heart and open my mind and go back and figure out something that made me feel really connected there and that opened my whole conscience to another way of being a human on Earth. So that's why I went back. It was about growth and self-discovery and hopefully some kind of service to connecting between cultures.
So this was a very impactful trip for you. Now, were you studying Chinese before you went on that trip?
I was not.
Or was it like you started afterwards?
I started afterwards. I was 18 then. And then I went back 6 months later to Sichuan province. And that's where I met old lady Wong, Lao Wong.
Tell me about her.
Oh, my goodness. Oh. Old lady Wong, she sits right up there and stares down at me every day. I got a picture of her in my room. I was sitting on the steps of the dormitory at the Keji Dashue at the time. It was the technical university. I was sitting on the foreign student steps and this old lady shuffled by with her cute little bob and her Mao jacket. And again, this is 1997. And I hadn't met many people who spoke perfect English. And she was following after this little toe-headed kid. A handkerchief dropped out of the back of pocket onto the ground. I was like, oh no. So I went over and I picked it up and I said, excuse me, is this your handkerchief? And she turns around and she was like, it is my handkerchief. Well, thank you so much for returning it to me. And I was like, wow, your English is amazing. And she said, can you speak Chinese? And I was like, dian, you know? And she was like,
yeah.
Immediately said to me, you are going to come to my house and I'm going to feed you dumplings and I'm going to teach you Chinese.
Wow.
So I started going to old lady Wong's socialist retirement block apartment building, and I'd walk up the 5 brick and mortar stairs that were partially outside to her front door. And every week I'd go knock on her door and hear her little shuffle, and she'd come open the door and sit me down at this little old creaky wooden table next to a window that only had wooden shutters. She'd bring in the chrysanthemum tea and I'd sit there and drink Jiuhua Cha, and she'd tell me stories. And so stories and old lady Wang are what made me fall deeply in love with Chinese culture and made me feel incredibly connected to the universal themes of heroism and grief and persistence and strife and success and all the things that are in all of the human stories that relate to the fact that we're just stuck inside human bodies with these big spirits trying to function in a limited way, you know?
Wow, she sounds like a wonderful lady and made a big impression on you, obviously, right?
Yeah, and a big impression because I gained 20 pounds from her dumplings. And I got off the plane at the end of my 6 months in Sichuan, and my parents were like, oh, remember, we didn't have like FaceTime or Zoom or anything back then. So they were just like, wow, you look different. Yeah. I had to go buy all new clothes. And Lord knows in Sichuan, they didn't have the right size for me anyway. So I had to get them tailored, you know, to expandable waists and stuff so I could eat more dumplings.
Wow. So was that a study abroad program, or did you just go over there to learn Chinese?
No, it was a study abroad program through Pacific Lutheran University. I just started looking for places I could go in China that weren't the typical exchange locations, so I could really dive into even deeper discomfort, I suppose. Really, it was purposeful. You know, I wanted to like get in there. But the truth is, at the time, I didn't really understand the concept of regional dialects and what I would be encountering in terms of trying to study Putonghua in Chengdu at the time.
Yeah, I think that's a great aspect. You know, a lot of people who haven't been to China, and even if you've just been to the big cities, a lot of people aren't aware of that. How diverse and like the different accents, and sometimes a lot of areas, they don't even speak Putonghua.
Right.
They just have their local language. It's not even dialect, it's a language.
Right. That 6 months was really powerful for me because along with my roommate, Julie, who is from California, at the time, you could easily count the number of foreigners that were in Chengdu, including like Japanese and Korean and everything. And we all met at this one bar. There's this old bar on this dusty, dirty street. My dad came to visit Chengdu, and he said it looked like the Star Wars bar. You walked in there, and there just were, there were like the same 100 people coming in and out that were all foreigners in Chengdu, and there was nothing else like it. You know, I've never experienced anything else like it. And the way we were brought together, despite our differences, just because we were foreigners in a land that was highly homogenized, you know? Yeah, that was a really special time. And I traveled up to Qinghai, to the Tibetan Plateau, and Sichuan along the Tibetan Plateau, and by train up into Lanzhou, and then took the sleeper bus. I mean, at the time, they didn't have the same kind of transportation. You know, it's a sleeper bus out to Urumqi, and then Urumqi to Kashgar on a sleeper bus, and just did that adventuring that you only can do in your early 20s when you feel invincible.
And you've got an ironclad stomach as well.
There were some moments, I'll tell you. Barfing out the window of the 72-hour sleeper bus from Urumqi to Lanzhou was brutal, yeah.
Oh, that's a long ride. I mean, you're crossing over the Gobi Desert there.
We crossed the Gobi Desert in a sleeper bus. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
I've been on those sleeper buses. Let's put it this way. I didn't do a lot of sleeping.
Exactly. And people stood the whole way, right? There were people who bought tickets and they stood the entire time, or they'd sit down on their suitcase if there was room.
That's like a Chinese superpower. Oh,
that is.
The ability to just fall asleep like in the most obtuse places, right?
It is a superpower. Oh my gosh. Yeah. It taught me a lot about how to tour as a musician, to tell you the truth.
And
now, obviously, being a tourist in China is a totally different affair, and you can get 5-star treatment and transportation and everything to almost anywhere you want to go. Not anywhere, but major spots. I'm really grateful I had the experience I did. And in fact, some people who were kind of babies of learning Chinese language in the 90s call it a very special time. Mm-hmm. There was this rebirth of connection going on since the 80s, and there was sort of a new comfort with foreigners being around, but it was still rare enough that it was special. And I've had my moments of feeling jaded and worried very much about my connection to how China's changing and where I fit into it and how America's changing and how I fit into it. But I think it's just always staying present and just loving unconditionally the fact that there's this need for one another in order to know our true selves.
Mm. It sounds like you had some really influential experiences at this stage in your life.
at what point did you decide Chinese is going to be a really important part of my life? And I know later on you had ambitions for like law school. Where did that decision happen? And what kind of were those influences that pushed you in that direction?
When I came back from Chengdu, from Sichuan, after those very intense and mind and heart opening 6 months, I remember landing. At the time, my parents lived in Minneapolis. I landed in Minneapolis, and I remember distinctly how empty the airport felt and how empty the roads seemed just driving in the car back home, and how empty my neighborhood felt. And this wave of loneliness swept over me. I thought it would be like relief, but it was this sense of like this loss of color. Life in Technicolor had disappeared. And then I started talking to my relatives and my friends after returning from Sichuan. And I distinctly remember one call with a relative in southern Minnesota who called and said, "Hey, how was your trip, honey? How was Japan?" It's hilarious. But there was also a piece of me that's like, oh man, like this is how a lot of America is. It doesn't know the difference between Asian countries. And there's a lack of, I'd like to call it self-possession, but I think I'd call it self-obsession, that doesn't allow us to allow American culture to look beyond. There's this sense that we want everything to mirror us, to be in our image. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an imperialistic problem and part of our need to decolonize our own minds in America. But I was ashamed. I was ashamed that that's how I used to think and that that's where I come from. And I wanted to do something about creating stronger connections, stronger impressions of the ways that we so deeply share the same human experience. So that's what happened, was the reverse culture shock coming back to America made me go, I am marrying myself to this mission to care deeply about my country and where I come from, and also this place that has adopted me to a certain extent, you know, and helped me realize myself and my native heritage.
So you're studying Chinese at this point, and it sounds like you have this really strong connection. But tell me about that point where you decided, hey, I want to go apply for law school. Where was your Chinese at this stage?
My Chinese ability was really limited to, and honestly, my Chinese ability is limited, but...
Well, mine too.
back. My love is not limited, but my ability is limited. Back then, I had only had 5 weeks at Fudan University in Shanghai, and of an opening understanding at all of tones and Chinese and everything. And then 6 months of very spotty, non-Putonghua Mandarin teaching. I was extremely limited in my ability. When I returned back to college, I was at the Colorado College. They also didn't have a very strong program. I was, I think, the second Asian studies major that ever graduated. So I took the Chinese that I could at the school, but it topped out at like level three. I really wanted to go deeper. And so I went to Middlebury College for their Middlebury program, the intensive program.
Yeah, I hear that's a great program.
Wonderful. Yeah, and that was in 98, I think. And I did level two there. And it was a struggle. I mean, it's not easy, people.
As usual. And it was less easy then than it is now, right? With all the tools we have,
yes,
right?
Yes, it's true. It's true. I mean, everything had to be looked up in the Matthews Chinese English Dictionary. It was page turning. It was tons of page turning,
yeah.
You know?
Looking up radicals and stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's...
Yeah, thank God that's over. Then after I came back from Middlebury, it was still very clear that I couldn't continue my studies and get to a point where I wanted to get to. I wanted to do a thesis that involved early 20th century literature in China, and I wanted to be able to read it and speak to it from more ancient Chinese perspective. So I went up to mm-hmm. University of Colorado, and I just did a semester of intensive level three Chinese. And then I came back and I did my thesis. And then that's when I moved to Vermont with my boyfriend at the time. And I did Middlebury again. And I got into lobbying and realized that I thought maybe some government was really interesting to me in law and ethics. Mind you, I was still not a musician, right, at this point.
Yeah, yeah.
So I decided to try to go to school in China. So I started studying for the Hanyu Shuiping Kaoshi.
HSK.
And I went up to McGill University to do studying in Montreal. And so I would go up there every couple of months and do these intensive studies, and then I took the HSK up there. And I just barely passed enough, you know. And when I say law school in China, it's like a law master's, right? You can't really get a JD. So it's really like I probably would have gone and done some kind of undergrad work for a year just to get my Chinese really going, and then I would have started the master's in law. So yes, I had applied to Peking University, and I would have been able to go. So that's when I decided, okay, I'm going to go over to China, and I know I'm going to end up being one of those people that I've met before that is like a foreigner who lives in a cubicle in Beijing or Shanghai. And once I'm done with school, and I'm going to probably just engage in this life until things really get going for my career. So I'm probably going to be in a hole for 10 years, and I'll come back to the States for 2 weeks a year, you know? So I want to explore America a little bit before I leave, because people are always asking me about America. And I became so obsessed at the age of 18 with China, I never really took that time to go, oh, but where am I from? Mm-hmm. And, you know, that self-realization as a teenager is more about like, oh, I'm in my own flesh. I'm in my own skin. I can make my own decisions. But I hadn't come to the point where like I was like, ooh, in the big picture, I'm an American, and there's all these countries and these diasporas of cultures, and I fit in there where? And what is my country, and what's the special offering of the culture that I come from? I hadn't considered any of that. I decided I need to bring a little piece of America with me and just take a moment to reflect. And so I thought, well, I'm going to do some things I've always wanted to do. I wanted to explore banjo music a little bit because my boyfriend had been in a bluegrass band, and I'd learned enough about bluegrass to know that I liked old-time music better. There's this delineation between old-time and bluegrass music, and old-time is like, that's a part of our American ancestry. And when I say American, I mean like immigrants coming to America and the cultures meshing in a very distinct and magical way to create this really powerful music that became the underpinning for blues and rock and roll. I mean, the world has gone mad with what happened when Africa and Ireland and Scotland met in our hollers and our hills on the eastern seaboard.
And I know the banjo is like that one uniquely American instrument.
Yes, and I suppose every instrument could be said to be that, but the banjo has this very powerful history because it is African. And because it's West African.
Oh, is it?
It is.
Oh, I thought it was one of the uniquely American instruments, but no, it's West
right.
African.
Right, and you know, with this whole conversation going on in our country around white supremacy, that's one of the stories that has been covered up. It's a West African instrument, probably from the Gambia, where the capital is Banjul, and all of the banjos are made from the Banjul trees.
And well, there you go. I had no idea at all.
Yes. So something that we consider deeply American, which African ancestry in America is deeply American too, but it just hasn't been an acknowledged piece of the banjo's history. So I'm really grateful for the challenging nature of the conversation and the history that the banjo brings up, because it came over with Africans who were captured and imprisoned and put on boats to become slaves in America. Wow. And enslaved humans that came to America because white people who owned farms wanted labor that was incredibly cheap. So they stripped lives away and brought these folks over. And what the slave traders realized was that if there was a local musician in Africa from the hometown where they had stolen all these people from playing music, more of them would survive to the other side, because they would lose about 40% of the people, because they would die from the harsh conditions without food, without a bathroom, without anything, 4 weeks stacked on top of each other in crates. So with a person playing the instrument, a much higher percentage of people, their spirits would literally stay intact with their bodies.
That's very interesting.
Isn't it? And so most people think of it as a white Southern instrument, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can count me among one of those. But now I know
better. Right. No, it's so good to hear these truths, isn't it? So this is part of the reason I fell in love with the banjo, is because it encompasses this amazing history and a piece of social justice that just around race and equality and shared ancestry that we like to segregate, that really spoke to my heart. And it also spoke to the idea of the banjo being a connection between all of us. And that really spoke to me. And the more I learned about the banjo, the more those principles of its history spoke to me. But I decided I wanted to dive in even more to the banjo. So I went down to Kentucky to the International Bluegrass Music Association convention. And knowing very little, I could eke out frailing, you know, five songs on the banjo and singing. And one of them was a translation of a Gillian Welch song into Chinese.
Wow, cool.
Oh, Xiao Hong Niao Kai Ko Jing Ho.
Wow.
And so I was just hanging out in the lobby, and there weren't that many young women at the IBMA at the time. And that's changed a lot, actually, with all of our awareness of inclusivity. But at the time, there weren't. And so the few young women that I met there, we decided we were going to jam on the fifth floor elevator lobby at like midnight one night. And I showed up and I was like, guys, I only know like five songs. Is that okay? So we played those five songs over and over again. And a record executive from a bluegrass folk label saw us playing and really thought it was special. And that was the first time in my life that I felt like I got this outside affirmation from somebody in the industry that I should do music. So they wanted to give us a record deal. It didn't happen, but it was a reason that I went to Nashville and I cut a demo in a studio and sang onto a microphone in a studio for the first time in my life, you know?
Wow, that's
amazing. It was really something. I said, do you guys want the Chinese song? And they were like, no thanks, you know? So
we'll pass.
That, yes. And that began my awareness that me looking the way I look and singing Chinese songs wasn't something that would necessarily fit into the music industry. And I liked the challenge of that. And I thought, well, it should have a place in the music industry just because it's an artist's voice, and why not? So I started perceiving myself as an artist for the first time in my life. And that opened all kinds of doors. And I got a job right when I moved to Nashville. Literally on the way down, I called the U.S.-China Friendship Association of Nashville, which had like five members. And I said, I'm looking for a job. I speak some Chinese. I have some awareness of Chinese culture. And so I started working for a pharmaceutical company with a wholly owned subsidiary in Zhejiang. I started working for them. And within a year, I was in a coffee shop and a woman said, oh, I like your shirt. She was standing behind me and I was like, oh, thanks. And she said, are you an artist? And I was like, I think so. Yeah, I think I am. And
she's, Yes, I am.
Okay, I think so. And she said, well, do you have any demos? And I said, well, not of my own music, no. And she was like, well, get one and send it to me. And she handed me her card. And she was from Network Records up in Canada. So I made a demo and I sent it to her and I was offered a record deal. I mean, it was ridiculous. These things don't happen. They shouldn't happen. I don't know why.
But they did.
But they did. And this company, being in Canada, in Vancouver, with a very large Chinese population, was very open to the idea that I would have a language-integrated record. So that's where my integrated language singing playing began, was with a home on Network Records.
You had opportunities that were presented to you, I guess, in exclusive of your language ability, right? But it seems like you now, hey, I'm going to connect my talents with Chinese and maybe Chinese culture.
Yeah, right? Yeah, and use it for hopefully as a piece of an effort to connect cultures.
So tell me about some of the other things that you've done to make that connection or even strengthen that. Because I know you've done crossover albums, so to speak.
Yeah, well, I'd say from 2003 to 2013, so for 10 years, I went back and forth to China almost every year. And thanks to some really deep friendships, a fellow named John Campbell lived in Beijing for a long time. And he and I kind of got into cahoots. And he was starting to produce like a show here or there for people. And so I called him and I, you know, at one point when I realized I wasn't going to go back to law school, I called my friends who were in China, a couple of friends that I wanted to let know, I'm not coming back. I got offered a record deal. And they're like, you're... like, what music can you play? And I'm like, I play the banjo now and I sing. And, you know, I got really enamored with this piece of American history. And I wanted to be able to bring something to share with my Chinese friends, you know? And I thought it would be really useful, like when I was working at a law firm, to have this banjo I could show up at karaoke with clients with and be like, hey, guys, you know what I'm talking about. I mean, that's a power move. You know, that's power play right there.
They're gonna love that.
So I thought it would be really useful for my business stuff, too, you know. I said, you know, I just want to come back and visit. So I'm just going to come back while I have some time off in between work and these tours I'm starting to do and recording I'm starting to do. And he said, well, why don't you come play some music here? Just throw your banjo on your back and bring it. I'll book you a couple shows. And then I started thinking, oh my gosh, if you're going to book a couple shows, should I bring like a band to play with or something, you know, because I still only knew like 5 or 6 songs, you know. And he's like, sure. So I asked the couple of friends that I had made in Nashville who I really jived with, and they still are some of my best friends today. And I took this little 3-person band with me, and we slept on John's sofas and on his floor. And we played clubs in Beijing in 2003. And then he said, well, let's go down to Shanghai and do some. So we went down to Shanghai. And then he was smart enough to piece all these things together. And today he's still, now he lives in Toronto, but for a long time he produced independent tours of China, which is not easy. And no, it's not a big moneymaker. So, but we did a lot of sleeping on couches and really crappy hotels and taking every form of transportation you could imagine with all of our crazy instruments on our backs and our bags and going all over China. And eventually it led to a lot of cooperation with the State Department, which was wonderful, and local consulates. So almost every time I came over after that, I'd make a trip to Shanghai, Guangzhou, and Chengdu to do regional shows, just showcasing American traditional music. And I'd get to talk about the history of the banjo and the beautiful melding of cultures that happened in early America, despite the hard stories that came with them. So I started to learn to use my Chinese to do that specific thing, which was to make music, to host an MC show in Chinese, saying the things that were important to me about the history of the banjo and the people I was playing with and about the collaborators I would work with. Because one of the main things I would request from the consulates or from the embassy was, can you please help find collaborators so that at the end of the show, maybe we can play 3 or 4 songs together and experience playing together and show to other people that we can play together.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay. I'm curious. Do you have any interesting stories from that? Special moments, perhaps?
Oh, a flood of...
Which one, right?
are coming at me right now. There was playing the Animal Husbandry College of Tibet. They'd never seen foreigners before. So we were warned by our Chinese handlers that we weren't allowed to interact with anybody. And so the mere...
Is Tibet a little sensitive there too?
Yes. Know, and I was it was amazing at all that we were allowed to tour there. And it was an official tour between the U.S. State Department and the Chinese Wenhuabu and the Cultural Bureau. And they set it up and we had handlers that watched us closely. And that was important to them and important to us as a result. But it limited our interaction with people. But it was still the amazing energy of meeting people who had never seen people like us and us meeting people... who, you know, my 3 other bandmates had never seen people dressed up in hides and wearing Tibetan headgear. And it was just the energy between all of us was like, oh my gosh, we're all so different, you know. Even we were on stage and they were in the audience. And they clapped at the funniest times. They did not clap at the end of the songs. They would clap somewhere in the middle of the song and then we'd end the song and nobody would clap. And we'd have to figure out what we were doing. And of course, I'm speaking in Chinese, which they don't even understand. Started speaking in English because I realized maybe that was a friendlier language to speak, actually. I mean, experiences like going from playing like the Animal Husbandry College of Niying Tree, it was called, and then flying and the next week playing Shanghai Music Conservatory. I mean, what a trip. At the Shanghai Music Conservatory, everybody was so... I mean, of course, conservatories encourage an elitism in America, everywhere around the world. So there was a sense that we were simple folk musicians and they were kind of being forced to watch us. And this is so boring. And they were watching like, you know, like their hand, you know, like they got slobber face and their hands mushing against their eye. And yeah, so the contrast was really stunning, all the different places we played. There is one story that was really powerful for me in Lanzhou. And we called ahead to see if the State Department called ahead to the local Lanzhou Wenhuabu and asked if anybody could collaborate with us for this one show we were going to have at the theater downtown. But they sent a 12 girls band to collaborate with us. So 12 young women showed up with their instruments, only knowing how to play to a track. And this happened a lot, actually. And I started knowing what to ask, asking that we don't play to a track. We don't play to a CD. We play live music. And that could be very, very hard to find collaborators who are willing to do that. But in this case, they sent the 12 girls band, and we ended up playing to a track with them because that's what worked for them. But then they also sent this elder Arhu master.
Arhu. Yeah, I love the
me
Arhu.
Too, especially when it's played well, so cool. Right?
It can be sometimes like, you know, a beginner playing the violin.
Yes, like, the dying cat, you know, but, thing. Yeah.
But it can be, when played right, it can be very beautiful. It's that distinct, anyone listening, it's that distinctly, how would we describe it? That sounds like the mysterious, I don't know how to even say, right?
Yeah. The resonance and the microtones that can be achieved on an arhu are really different than on a fretboard because the strings sit in the air. So there's a mysteriousness to that quality of not having something hard to bump into. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of air around the sound. So this arhu master shows up and he looks at me and he says, 中国乐手和美国乐手不合作音乐. He was just like, we really can't collaborate on music. I'm sorry, but Americans and Chinese were too different. And I said, oh, wow. I was really surprised that the Cultural Bureau sent somebody who would say that, you know. But I loved it, too. I was like, dang, this is like a guy from Jersey, you know. He's like, yeah, I can't work with you, you know. And I said, okay, I mean, you might be right. We might not work well together. And then I was like, but do you mind playing something for us? Because we've come so far and we just so love to hear what you play. So he started playing this beautiful Tibetan melody on the arhu. It has that sort of high mountain holler that you can find in America, too, in those beautiful soaring Scottish pieces that made their way to the Appalachian Mountains. It was just really beautiful. And our fiddler pulled out his fiddle and started just pulling on a string and finding the pitch to match this guy. And so we all found it and started just sort of droning along with him. And then some of the musicians started finding some harmony notes that really kind of fleshed out some beautiful harmony under it. And then the fiddler actually started catching pieces of the melody and started playing it with him. And when he stopped playing, he looked at all of us and then he started playing something else. So we started playing with him again. And at the end of the night, he came to me and he said, you know, I discovered something tonight, that music isn't about people of different nations playing together. It's hearts connecting.
Beautiful.
Xin he xin, the gou tong, so communication between hearts. And that was very beautiful. He opened my eyes to the fact that that's what it is. That's what we do. So no matter what our perception or our fixed position that we think we exist within, it's an illusion. You know?
Wow.
It's all hearts communicating.
That sounds like an amazing experience.
And it's about listening. I think that's one of the things that I'd say my whole path with Chinese has gone from desperately trying to grasp onto figuring out how to shape my mouth around the tones and the words and get them out to having enough agency with the language to wonder, okay, now I can speak, but what am I going to say? Like, what do I have to say, you know? Am I going to be a transactional speaker or am I going to be a speaker that offers something to the craft of learning from the position I sit within? And then it became about, okay, maybe understanding what I need to say actually comes from listening. I think that's also a similar journey with music, is trying so hard to be able to find the notes and know where they are. And then once you have the agency to find the notes, what in the heck are you actually going to play on your instrument, right? And then after you've done that, you realize, I'm not actually that interesting unless I listen. And then you start listening. And that's where meaning comes from, is in the listening and the finding of each other. So I think the parallel between the musical depth of connection and what language can be, how language can serve this purpose of hearts connecting, it takes journeying, it takes discomfort, it takes deep listening, you know?
I always talk about on this podcast is that Chinese is just a tool. In fact, language in general is a tool, but it allows us to make those connections, right? And that facilitate deeper relationships and understanding and opening our minds and our hearts to things that, you know, we wouldn't be exposed to otherwise, and perhaps things we wouldn't even have considered if we hadn't been able to make those connections in life.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I feel like that listening and that connecting is our awareness of that itself is evolving as humans right now to the point where empathy isn't so much about trying to stand in another person's shoes, but it's more about orienting ourselves to have a great view and be within earshot of trying to understand what it is like for them without trying to take that space. And that's where I'm at on that journey now. And so my most recent collaboration is with Wu Fei.
That album, I've listened to it.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. It has such a mix and blend and here and there. Yeah, it's pretty cool. Maybe you could talk about that.
Yeah. So Wufei is a friend that I made. She and I share this experience of becoming young adults in one another's country. So she grew up in Beijing, and she's a very different musician than me because she grew up in the path of the Jinsita. You know, she was the top of the Golden Tower, you know, and she went to the hardest composition school to get into at the China Conservatory and was one of the 13 kids picked from China out of hundreds of thousands to do this program, wow. You know.
To listeners, that's actually a big, big deal. You know, how competitive. A lot of people may not understand how competitive it is among kids there in China.
Yes.
So it can be very, very competitive.
Yes. And what a surprise for her to end up playing with this girl who lives in Nashville, Tennessee, that started her musical journey, my musical journey, when I was in my early 20s. But we share this experience of she came to America when she was 19. I went to China when I was 18. And then those 10, 15 years of our lives where we spent a significant amount of time in one another's cultures. Mm. And so when we finally met in 2005, I think, we met in Colorado because a radio guy said we should meet, and I took his advice, even though a lot of people will say to me, oh, you've got to meet my Chinese friend, you know? Like, I would love to, sure. But I really took him up on it, and she came and played music with us that night, and it was just such a cool fit. She was on a path, and it still is, being very adventuresome with her music, because her journey comes from fitting within the lines, doing things just as her teachers told her, to jumping off the cliff into improvisation once she came to America and found different influences here. And that's been a profound musical journey for her. I think that's the basic essence of what she's doing in her life of music, is finding that place in between, that American concept of creativity and jumping into the chasm of the unknown, and the Chinese precision and virtuosity, the warrior musician, you know.
Even like Chinese opera is like the quality of like the singer is how well can they reproduce the masters, right? It's not necessarily about improvisation or innovation. It's about how closely you can replicate.
And it's not that I can experience what she experienced, but I get it. I can talk to her and know her, know that. You know, a number of people in her life, her husband, of course, but people that really have enough of an understanding to feel that she might feel understood. And then I feel that she understood me and that the times in the 90s and the early aughts that I spent in her country and playing music. At one point, I knew the music scene better than her because she'd been living in America and I'd been going back and forth to China. And she said, I'm moving back to Beijing and I'm going to make music. And I was like, who are you going to make improvisational Chinese music with? Like, I can't really picture it. You know, I met a lot of the players. I knew a lot of the players in the scene, you know. And she went back and she was like, Abby, there's nobody to play with here, you know. And she played with foreigners who would come through. She had this group of guys, I think from Norway or something, that they would play together. Uh-huh. But it was hard to come by, you know. So those were like the aspects of things. She understood. She had seen Doc Watson in Boulder, Colorado. So she knew a lot about where I was coming from. She loved folk music. She grew up with folk music. It was actually a very important piece of her conservatory training, was learning folk musics from different regions. And so I had traveled so widely that I'd played with folk musicians from a lot of these different churches. We'd sit on the porch and just yap about things. She'd tell stories. I'd tell stories. You know, it was really fun. And so one day when she and Jeremy decided to leave Beijing, their kids were having a lot of trouble with pollution. They moved back here to Nashville, Tennessee, and they live a half an hour away now. And we decided it was time for us to make a duo record together. Oh. And they were all based on folk music that we both loved and the idea of weaving together folk music from America and the U.S. and from lots of different parts of America and a lot of different parts of China. And we both have the awareness to care about geeky details that other people wouldn't really think about. And maybe you can,
you're musicians,
you know, maybe you can hear the sort of the depth of caring we have for where these songs come from and a respect for how they need to meet each other. But a lot of the songs were just literally counterpoint. You know, I'd sing Water is Wide and she'd sing Usuli, boat song. Or I'd sing Roving Cowboy and she would sing Avarguli. And we'd figure out how to match 4-4 and 3-4 time and meet at the end. And it was a level of intimate diving into the traditions and where they meet and how we can use our own ability to meet them and to weave them together. Because people will say, oh, how does that go together? And it's like, well, it doesn't go together unless two people care a lot and listen and want to reach out to each other. And that's when it works.
So, Abby, I'd like to hear from you. What would you tell someone, or what advice would you give to someone who's learning Chinese right now?
Fall in love with something about it. Just fall in love with it. Whether it's the way the strokes create the radicals, create tens of thousands of characters, and the incredible exponentiality of that, or if it's just the subtle way the tones make you think again about the ugliness of American English, or if it's some piece of Anhui opera that you heard that you're like, oh my God, if only I could like decode that and make sense of it. Or you just love going to regional Chinese soccer games and stadiums. Or if you have a friend that lives down the hall from you in your dormitory who is Malay Chinese and you want to be able to relate and know really what Lunar New Year is all about. Like whatever it is, if there's some doorway or window into just falling madly in love with it and having a passion for it, then it's all going to waterfall into this beautiful river that connects us all in the ocean, you know?
That's beautiful. Abigail, you definitely have a way with words. And not just that, a way with music and expressing your heart and your mind, your ideals. And I appreciate you so much for taking the time to share that with us.
Thank you, Jared. Going around this world, baby mine. Going around this world, baby mine. Going around this world, I'm a banjo picking girl. Going around this world, baby mine.
You have been listening to the You Can Learn Chinese podcast. Help us spread the word by sharing this with your friends, classmates, teachers, cousins, swimmer, presenter, sleeper, realtor, dancer, driver, foodie, philosopher, and that one guy named Stan. You can subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And please write us a review so we know how we're doing. You can find us on Facebook and at mandarincompanion.com. Apologies to John Cena, we just ran out of time. The You Can Learn Chinese podcast is produced by myself, Jared Turner, and our editor is Kaiser Guo at SubChina, and interview editor is James Harper with Filter Productions. I'd like to thank our guest, Abigail Washburn, and of course, thanks to my co-host, the man, the myth, the legend, John Passon. See you next time. Baby, mine. 千里有人想回来。